Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 24th of August, these are our main stories. The Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has ordered the military to help fight the devastating fires in the Amazon rainforest after European leaders threatened to scrap a major trade deal. Donald Trump gives a furious response to China's latest tariffs, saying he's ordering American firms to look for alternative places to do business. The president's also called the head of the US Federal Reserve an enemy of the country. Also in this podcast,
we now have a real chance to have a pure northern white rhino embryo. It's true that we need to find suitable surrogate mothers.
The efforts scientists in Kenya are making to save a species from extinction. First to Brazil and the Amazon rainforest, where in recent days there have been thousands of fires, sending large plumes of smoke across the region. They're even visible from 500 kilometres up in space. Concern is growing internationally. One comment on a BBC World Service webpage simply read, "The lungs of the planet are on fire." That has implications for us all. The Amazon rainforest is home to more than half the world's species of plants and animals. But over the last 40 years, this great verdant tract has been increasingly threatened by deforestation, primarily to make way for logging, farming and mining. Now, several European leaders have said they are prepared to scrap huge trade deals with South America unless Brazil takes action to curb the current forest fires. And a short time ago, as we were recording this podcast, the Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro issued a decree authorising the deployment of armed forces to tackle the forest fires in the Amazon region. Soldiers will be sent into nature reserves, indigenous lands and border areas. For more, here's our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Daniel Galas.
The Amazon, one of the world's major sources of oxygen, is currently experiencing a record number of fires. Since Tuesday, there have been more than 2,500 active blazes. And satellite data published by the Brazilian government itself shows that the total number of fires has risen by 85% compared with a year ago. President Jair Bolsonaro insists his policies are not to blame. He's argued it's season when farmers burn land to clear it before planting. He's also accused non-governmental organizations of starting fires to damage his image, but admits he can't prove his claims.
There is no proof of this. Nobody writes down, "I'm going to start a fire there." It doesn't happen. If you don't catch the person in the act, those who are burning the Amazon, find those who made them do it. This is a crime.
But environmentalists like Greenpeace's Márcio Astreni are furious.
Actually, it's Bolsonaro who is responsible for what is happening in the Amazon. He promotes policies that encourage environmental crime, which make culprits feel comfortable.
Mr. Bolsonaro says he's considering a range of options to deal with the fires. Meanwhile, people in the Amazon have been suffering with the consequences. Members of the Vura tribe, who live in one of the most affected areas by wildfires, say the situation has only been getting worse. Handek Vakana Mura is one of the tribe's leaders.
With each passing day, we see the destruction advance, deforestation, invasion, logging. We're sad because the forest is dying at every moment. We feel the climate changing, and the world needs the forest. We need it, and our children need it.
They will now be waiting anxiously to see how the international community responds when world leaders meet to discuss the situation at the G7 summit.
Daniel Galas. Camila Mota of BBC Brazil is in the state of Rondônia, which borders Bolivia. She sent this report just metres away from the flames.
Firefighters in the state of Rondônia, one of the most affected by the Amazon fires, have been working here for the past 2 weeks using blowers and gnat water, trying to put out the flames. But resources are an issue here, as it's a vast area with few people on the ground and a tight budget. The Amazon Fund, we were told, was key, for example, to help finance an airplane used in oversight operations. But low humidity and strong winds add to the challenge, as sometimes the fire can spread as fast as 30 or 40 kilometers per hour.
Camila Mota. Meanwhile, thousands of people have joined protests outside Brazilian embassies across Europe, demanding that President Bolsonaro takes immediate action to deal with the fires. Our diplomatic correspondent James Robbins considers the impact the Brazilian leaders' policies have had on the Amazon.
From the moment President Bolsonaro took office at the beginning of this year, Brazil's approach to climate change has taken a radical turn. The country's previously had leaders proud of Rio's role as the city where global agreements were signed to limit temperature rise. Now it's led by a right-wing climate skeptic much closer to Donald Trump's politics. Although President Bolsonaro did back away from taking Brazil out of the Paris Climate Accord, he actively favours big farming, agribusiness. Environmental laws have been diluted and fines for breaking them cut. At the same time, he's reducing protections for the indigenous people of the Amazon rainforest, seeing them as barriers to commercial exploitation of the region. Mr. Bolsonaro portrays himself as the victim, not the villain. Demonized by climate activists and Western governments, he accuses of colonial interference. I used to be called Captain Chainsaw, he's quoted as saying. Now I am Nero, setting the Amazon aflame. But the president may have to change course on the Amazon. There's evidence so many Brazilians share the global alarm about the fires that they must include significant numbers of his core supporters. And the fact that intense smoke from the fires has darkened skies over São Paulo, the country's largest city, won't have helped his case either.
James Robbins. Now, the BBC put in an interview request for the Brazilian ambassador to London. He wasn't able to do an interview, but they did send a statement read here by one of our team.
The government of Brazil is mobilising considerable resources to combat the fire spots recently observed in several Brazilian states. Brazil has probably the strictest environmental legislation in the world. It's been able to preserve more than 60% of its territory with native vegetation. Current levels of illegal deforestation are 72% below those of 2004. The Brazilian government is working hard to reduce these figures even further. The truth is, protecting the Amazon is an unwavering commitment of the Brazilian government.
American companies have been, in President Trump's words, hereby ordered to take their businesses out of China. He's clearly not retreating in the two countries' trade war. In a series of angry tweets, the president said, "We don't need China, and frankly, we'd be better off without them." Mr. Trump has also been critical of Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, after he failed to confirm another cut in interest rates. I spoke to our correspondent Chris Buckler in Washington and asked him, why does President Trump say he's so keen on an interest rate cut?
In simple terms, he believes that lower interest rates would encourage spending by businesses and households and give a real economic boost to the US. Of course, he does also insist that the American economy is strong and doing well, but his constant argument is that it would be doing even better if interest rates were cut. And he points to lower interest rates being offered in some other countries. And it feels like this issue is really playing on his mind. And that's probably because analysts are studying the figures, and some have suggested that, yes, while growth has been good in America and unemployment is low, there are signs that things could slow down or even stall. And Mr. Trump's frustration might well be an indication of his own private desire to do something to keep the economy strong, particularly in the year ahead.
Yes, there's an election next year, of course. Does this rhetorical urgency, do his angry tweets make any difference to the decision makers at the Federal Reserve?
Well, members of the Fed are appointed by the president and approved by Congress, but they are politically independent. And perhaps a little too independent for Mr. Trump, because we have seen an astonishing series of attacks on Jerome Powell, who's the chairman of the Fed, America's central bank. They've questioned his judgment, his ability, and there are these tweets questioning whether he, Jerome Powell, or China's President Xi was the greater enemy to America. That is really pretty astonishing. But Jerome Powell has again been very careful with his words today, saying the US economy is in a favourable place and that the Federal Reserve will act as appropriate. So could there be another rate cut? Possibly. But a series of cuts which Mr. Trump wants, that looks rather unlikely.
China's announced new trade tariffs on American goods. Andrew Walker is with me in London. We'll hear from him in just a moment. But Chris, how is the White House reacting to that news?
Well, in other White Houses, you might expect a line like disappointed. It's not the case in this one. There were a furious series of tweets from Mr. Trump attacking China, threatening some sort of response and telling US companies with interest in China to simply look for alternative places to base their operations or find suppliers. The big question, of course, is what does a response mean? Is it another retaliation in what has been a bitter trade war that has seen a huge number of tit-for-tat tariffs already?
Thanks, Chris. As I said, our economics correspondent Andrew Walker is in the studio here in London. Andrew, China's announced tariffs on $75 billion worth of American goods. The US taxes hit around four times that value in Chinese goods. Do those numbers matter?
Well, they indicate the fact that the Chinese side exports a great deal more to the US than the other way round, which means that there is this imbalance in the amount of goods that they can subject to tariffs. But, you know, there is no question that notwithstanding the fact that the Chinese have got a smaller target, as it were, to aim at, that it what their actions that they have already taken have done significant harm to American businesses, and particularly farmers who've been affected by notably tariffs on their exports of soybeans. And that is both an economic issue in America's agricultural areas, and it's also a political problem for President Trump, because the agricultural industry was one that did vote for him in pretty strong numbers, and they have been feeling the pain.
Feel free to accuse me of oversimplifying. Does that mean that China's winning?
I think participants in trade wars generally do not win. They inflict harm on one another. I suppose you could argue, and I have seen some people suggesting, that Vietnam has made some gains already because of a significant amount of production that has shifted from China to Vietnam, and the country has seen its exports to the United States increase. But I think it's worth emphasising one point. It's not just a question, when you're assessing the harm you suffer in a trade war, of what happens to your exporters. Bear in mind that American industry is also having to pay more for a lot of the stuff that it imports from China, and indeed from other parts of the world, in relation to other tariffs that have been imposed on steel and aluminium. And so, you know, the damage can feed right through the supply chain, and American consumers can indeed end up spending more. And that's why most economists will tell you that in a trade war, both participants tend to inflict significant damage on themselves as well as on the other side.
Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker, and before him, you heard from Chris Buckler in Washington. Now, this weekend, celebrations will take place in Tokyo as the one-year countdown to the 2020 Paralympics begins. It's the second time the city will host the Games. The last time Tokyo hosted the Paralympics and Olympics, more than 50 years ago, the focus was on improving Japan's infrastructure with the creation of the famous bullet trains. But this time, organisers are hoping for a change in attitudes in a country where around 7% of people are registered disabled. From Tokyo, our disability correspondent Nikki Fox reports.
In almost a year's time, there are going to be more than 4,000 athletes with all different kinds of disabilities coming to the city. But also you're going to get disabled spectators, media, and they're all going to be living, sleeping, eating in this city. I've not seen that many disabled people since I've been here. And next year there's going to be a whole lot more.
I'm here with Keiichi Kimura, Paralympic hopeful, visually impaired swimmer. And what's it like as somebody with a visual impairment in Japan?
Right now, some visually impaired don't want to go out by themselves. But I hope next year's Paralympic Games, the society will change, and in Japanese, visually impaired person will go out by themselves, I think.
This is a problem Tokyo 2020's Vice President Yasushi Yamawaki recognises. He says the preparations for making the city, specifically hotels, accessible has been difficult.
Unfortunately, we don't see many people with a disability along the street or train or hotel. That's why hotel people don't know why they have to create an accessible room. So after 2020, I really like to see many people with a disability go out and use trains and facilities and travel.
So is that kind of
anything typical than having a step and not being able to get into a restaurant or a shop?
Yeah, in Japan there's a thing called a genkan, which is a step that goes into either restaurants or stores.
Taking me on a tour of the city is Josh Grisdale, who's used a wheelchair all his life. He moved to Japan 12 years ago and recognises the city has some access issues, but thinks things are improving.
Yeah, when I first came here, there's a lot more research needed. The accessibility changes have happened quickly, but of course it takes time. So there were a lot of places I couldn't go when I first came here, so I'd have to research whether I could get there or not, or maybe get off the station early and walk the rest of the way. But it's gotten a lot better.
At the Metropolitan Government building today, there was a queue to hold the Olympic and Paralympic torches. Here, officials told me they believe that Tokyo 2020 as a whole will only be viewed as a success if the Paralympics achieve its goal of changing attitudes. Many understand it's a tall order, but as with all Paralympic Games, it's what happens after that matters.
Nikki Fox in Japan. Now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service. Music Life takes you into the minds of leading musicians. Every week, a group of musicians get together on a sofa to talk about the creative process and how and why they do what they do. You'll hear stories about how to turn an idea into a song, how you know when a piece of music is finished, and how it feels once it's been released. That's Music Life from the BBC World Service. Just search for BBC Music Life wherever you get your podcasts. Health experts are warning that current efforts to combat malaria are inadequate. Each year, about 400,000 people, mostly children in Africa, die from the disease. Here's our senior Africa correspondent, Ansoy.
Progress towards ending malaria has stalled globally. The team of experts advising the World Health Organization on malaria eradication says the number of cases declined by more than a fifth and deaths fell by half from the year 2000 to 2015. But since then, nothing much has changed. Their report reveals that mosquito nets, insecticides, diagnostic tests and treatments being used today were developed decades ago. That, the scientists say, must change.
Ansoy. Next week sees the 25th anniversary of the IRA ceasefire, which paved the way for the Good Friday Agreement and the end of the conflict in Northern Ireland. Newly declassified British government documents show there was very little initial agreement between the various sides, and that initial talks were extraordinarily difficult. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page has been looking at the files.
On the 31st of August 1994, there was a Republican cavalcade through West Belfast to mark the IRA's announcement of what it called a cessation of military operations. Loyalist paramilitaries also declared a ceasefire 6 weeks later. The way was open for an end to the conflict. But the previously confidential papers show how delicate and difficult early negotiations were. The files contain the minutes of the first meeting between government officials and a Republican delegation, led by the late Martin McGuinness, a former IRA commander and Sinn Féin's chief negotiator. The lead civil servant, Quentin Thomas, is recorded as saying, "History grasps greedily at our back, the mortal hunger of the martyred past." But he added, "Let us begin together to work towards the future." Martin McGuinness surprised the official by asking, "How's Fred?" referring to a British intelligence officer who'd been involved in back-channel contacts. Mr. Thomas said he didn't know. The reply came, "I think you do." The historian Dr. Raymond Phoenix says the documents show how the foundations for a settlement were laid.
They see this as a moment of history. This could be the turning point in 750 to 800 years of turmoil, but they are talking about an accommodation.
The files show Republicans and Loyalists dismissed the government's request for disarmament, but asked for paramilitary prisoners to be released. Despite the early standoffs, the negotiations did progress, leading to the Good Friday Agreement 4 years afterwards.
Chris Page in Belfast. The American multi-billionaire David Koch, a major donor to conservative projects, has died at the age of 79. He and his brother Charles accumulated their vast fortune through their father's firm, Koch Industries, turning it into a huge industrial empire. They were jointly ranked by Forbes as the 11th richest people in the world this year. David Koch survived a plane collision in 1991. He said later his life had been spared for a purpose, to do good works, although critics said he was buying political influence to boost his business interests. Tara McKelvey, our correspondent in Washington, told Ben James more about David Koch.
David Koch was known for his charitable contributions. He gave like $1 billion to the arts and science, and there's a dinosaur wing in a New York museum that's named after him. But he was best known for his political contributions. He and his brother helped to support a group called Americans for Prosperity. It's like a right-wing advocacy organization. And they were also seen as responsible for fueling the growth of the Tea Party, like a right-wing movement within the Republican Party. And a lot of people say that they helped get President Trump elected. So however you see him, he's certainly a hugely important figure in U.S. politics, and his legacy will be felt for years.
Yeah, I've not heard so much about the Tea Party recently, but I suppose an important precursor of the wave that brought President Trump to office. Now, when we contacted you to get you on the programme earlier on to talk about this, you told us something we didn't know, actually. You're from the area of the US that the Koch brothers are big in.
That's right. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri, which is not Kansas, but I went to school in Kansas and certainly have spent a lot of time there. My family's there now. And the Koch brothers are lionized in Wichita. I mean, there are certainly legends there. David Koch and his brother. And what David Koch did, he described himself as a libertarian, and he sort of embodied and really believed deeply in this Kansas ethos, this belief in the freedom of the spirit, the individual spirit, and also entrepreneurship and the idea that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and a real resentment against the federal government. People are always railing against Washington and the swamp. And these are the ideals that David Koch grew up with and helped to sponsor through his political contributions.
Tara McKelvey on the life of the American multi-billionaire David Koch, who's died at the age of 79. Now to East Africa, and zoologists working in Kenya have successfully harvested eggs from the ovaries of the world's only two surviving northern white rhinos. They're trying to save the species from extinction and plan to fertilise the eggs with frozen sperm already collected from the last male of the species, which died last year. Now they need a surrogate rhino from another species. Jan Steskal from a zoo in the Czech Republic is leading the team and told Paul Henley more about the procedures, which some people may find disturbing.
The procedure to harvest eggs is really difficult. You have to understand that it's a white rhino is a really large animal. If you want to reach ovaries, you actually need to go about 1.5 or 2 meters inside the body of an animal. The only way how to do this is to go through rectum. Our colleagues from ISOW Berlin, they invented a special tool. So you reach with this tool close to ovaries, and then through ultrasound, you try to locate follicles. And when you see these follicles that contain oocytes, then you puncture the follicle, then you put a fluid in it, and then you aspirate it all together. And then you take vials with this fluid that contains oocytes under the microscope, and then you isolate oocytes, and then you prepare them for a transport to a laboratory.
And I guess failure wasn't really an option when you were dealing with one of only two survivors of the whole species.
To be honest, we were not sure whether we would be able to harvest oocytes, because last time when these females underwent health checks was 5 years ago. So we could not be sure whether the ovaries would be still functional. So I do not mean that the procedure would be complete failure, but it could happen that the ovaries would not give us any oocytes anymore.
So now you have the sperm from a northern white rhino and the egg from a northern white rhino. You need a surrogate, don't you? Presumably you'll be using a southern white rhino to give birth to the baby rhino.
Yes, as we now have a real chance to have a pure northern white rhino embryo, it's true that we need to find suitable surrogate mothers.
How hard will that be?
5 years ago, when we found out that the females are not capable of a natural reproduction anymore, we knew that there will be few steps that we have to somehow fulfill or overcome, because we can now say that we were able to learn how to produce an embryo. We are quite optimistic that we will overcome even the next steps, which is embryo transfer. And as you said, we will need a southern white rhino surrogate mothers We think that they're good candidates, could be here in Kenya. They could be even in the European zoos. The thing that makes it a bit problematic is that you actually need trained animals and prepare them for the embryo transfer. So otherwise, the embryo that you will put into a surrogate mother would not get into a full pregnancy.
Jan Steskal from the Dvor Králov Zoo in the Czech Republic. Now, here in London, I feel it's been a very long week, so it must surely be time for a beer. The alcoholic drink brewed from grains or hops has been around for thousands of years. Beer culture nowadays is largely associated with men, but some of the earliest brewers were women. A recent survey of British drinkers found that more than half of men have a beer once a week, but only one in five women do the same. The influential beer group, the Campaign for Real Ale, or CAMRA, wants to change this. At its annual event, the Great British Beer Festival, held recently in London, the organisation banned sexist beer names and imagery. Elizabeth Hodson went along for a drink.
Can I have a half of God's Twisted Sister, please? God's Twisted Sister. Is it an oatmeal stout?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, lovely. I'll get a half of that, please.
As a beer drinker, I'm used to seeing some unusual names on the board, but sexist branding, things like jingle knockers, knockers being a slang name for breasts, and village bike, an unflattering term for sexually liberated women, are increasingly coming off the menu. The Great British Beer Festival welcomes thousands of visitors each year, but this time around, drinkers will have seen far fewer innuendos on the pumps.
I'm Steph Morris, and I'm a camera volunteer at the Great British Beer Festival. This year we have actually banned sexist references on all of our beers and the marketing surrounding them, so like names, pump clips. There's no need for anyone to feel uncomfortable in seeing any of this or asking for any of this, and there's no need for anyone to feel uncomfortable when somebody asks for it either. There's always going to be a few people, the people that will say, oh, well, if you don't like it, just don't drink it. But you know what? I like beer and I'm going to carry on drinking beer. Why should anybody feel uncomfortable just because they want to drink a pint of beer?
At the festival, around one in four drinkers were women, and I asked some of them what they thought of the new policy.
I think it's a good idea because I come from the northwest near Manchester, and one of the biggest selling beers around the northwest is from a Stockport brewery, and it's called Dizzy Blonde. And you just think, oh God, it's just so disappointing that something so derogatory can be marketed and can be seen as such an acceptable kind of thing. Good beer is good beer. It's a shame that people feel that they have to sort of name it something which might be potentially offensive to other people.
I nearly ordered the beer earlier and then I saw the picture and it had a like slightly curvaceous woman on the picture and I didn't want to drink it anymore. So frankly for me, I think the more it can be like about the flavour and different things you can drink and less about stereotypes, better.
Away from the rarefied surroundings of the festival, I went to a pub in central London to find out what the average male drinker thought.
It wouldn't bother me, no, I don't think it would, no, to be honest.
I don't think it's necessary to have any sexist names. You'd be alienating a potential 50% of your customer basis, and I think it's just, yeah, silly and outdated.
Would you drink something that, you know, might be considered a bit sexist?
I mean, yeah, I probably would. I don't think it's anything personal or directed at individuals or, like, groups of people. I think it's just, you know, funny ways of characterising the beers, the drinks.
One way to drink beer on your own terms is to make it yourself. And that's exactly what Julie O'Grady has done. She's the co-founder of the Neptune Brewery in Liverpool, and she says that CAMRA's move is good business sense.
I think it's something that should have been done a long time ago, but as they say, better late than never. At the end of the day, beer's for everybody. You don't want to be alienating anyone from consuming your beer. I think it's important for marketing not to just be marketing to men, you know, not just to make it stereotypical that a man just drinks a beer, to be welcoming and say that you want to encourage different groups into beer. There are a lot of breweries out there that do support women in beer, who have women working for them, and that's fantastic. And there's a lot of breweries who don't. It is the best person for the job, and I do appreciate that, but there are some women out there with fantastic knowledge, just as much knowledge as men have.
As the owner of a brewery yourself and talking to other people in the industry, have you seen more women going into brewing?
Oh yeah, Yeah, the last couple of years, certainly there's been more women getting involved. For me, not just as a female brewery owner, as a woman in general, as a beer drinker, I think that's great.
Cheers to that. I would say bottoms up, but I'm not sure it's appropriate.
That report by Elizabeth Hodson at the Great British Beer Festival in London. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.